Today, Christmas opposites.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Originally, I was going to refer to that as Christmas opposition, but then people get the wrong idea. It's like, oh, those terrible people who hate Christmas, they're always opposed to Christmas. That's not what I'm referring to, although some of those topics will rise during the conversation today. Let me explain the kind of opposite I'm talking about. And by the way, in the background of my mind, far in the recesses of my mind, there is this analogy that is present. I'm not going to use it through the rest of the episode, but it is present, and you might as well know. It's an astronomy analogy that opposition for a planet happens. We use that word, opposition, when, for instance, the Earth is in line with Jupiter toward the Sun. It's a syzygy. It's also called a syzygy. So you have the Sun, and then you draw a line from that to the Earth, and you continue the line, and it goes through Jupiter. That's called opposition. And if you think about the disk that they are orbiting in, that's as close as Jupiter ever gets to the Earth. So the opposition is a big moment. There's also an opposite, if you think about it, because if you draw that straight line from the Earth through the Sun and go to the other side of the Sun, eventually Jupiter's going to be on that side as well. And it will still be opposite the Earth in relation to the Sun, but much further away, obviously, because the whole 90 million miles from the Sun to the Earth and from the Sun to where the Earth would be on that side, you get the impression, would have to be added to the distance to Jupiter. And so it's 180 million miles further away. So there's that kind of opposition as well. That is, in the back of my mind, that's the kind of opposition where it's on the opposite side of the Sun that people are talking about when they say, people oppose Christmas, they're fighting against it. And there really are efforts, you know, that suppress the efforts of Christianity, that suppress the work of Christ, that oppose the gospel and so on like that, and that we see that way, and that you can't help but see that way. It doesn't mean that we consider them an enemy that can't be loved or something that can't be resolved through the blood of Christ, but, you know, it's a different kind of opposition. But this kind of opposition, the kind on this side of the Sun, where Jupiter and the Earth are on the same side of the Sun, that's the kind of opposition I have in mind in this case. And it's funny because the opposition is as close as the two things get. And that basic concept that they are in opposition, but it's as close as they get to each other, that sort of drives the model for the conversation. So let me create the template for you for what I'm talking about. And then we'll use it three different times and then apply it overall in a fourth time. So the template is this. Christ represents a certain value, and it's a clear value. You know, he's kind, he's merciful, he's gracious, he's the Son of God. All the different characteristics about Christ are values, and they're things that are expressed in him. Christianity is supposed to convey those same values, and in many ways does. Sometimes we fall, but we mean to represent the same values as Christ. So in the template, step one will be, what does Christ represent? What do we expect from Christ? That's the value that goes with him. The second step would be what the holiday represents, the Christmas holiday. So here we are celebrating Christ, who represents this value, and here's the Christmas holiday, which seems to represent an opposite value. Most importantly, it seems to represent this thing, and that seems different, you know, from what we were seeing in Christ. And so what I want to do with those two steps is add two more. Number one, why that divergence, the difference between Christ and the holiday about him, is a legitimate, you know, recognition. There's a problem. There is a divergence. That would be step three. Step four would be conciliatory. It would be at least one attempt at reconciliation between those two views. And I'm not really saying this like, I'm a genius and I've discovered something you've never thought of before. You may think all of my episodes I think that. I don't, actually. What I actually think is that we find ourselves occasionally stuck in a rut. Or we find ourselves familiar with a certain way of feeling about some things, and we get trapped there. We get stuck there. And we suddenly think, oh, there, that's terrible, and that's dumb, and I want to criticize that, without having worked our way all the way through what I think this process, I'm hoping, will represent in some examples, and maybe get a different mindset about how we react when we find ourselves in tense situations. And that's why I'll use the word irony sometimes in these episodes, because I think the irony of it is that things can look to be in opposition and actually be much closer together than you think they are. That's what I mean by the irony of all of this discussion. So let me give you an example, and then we'll give a couple of other examples, and that's the whole point. Okay, first example. And I'll give a title to these first two examples. I don't do titles very much, but it's Christmas, you know, so I can create corny sayings just like everybody else. So I would call this one Holy Days and Holidays, right? So opposites, but you can see how close together those two things are, Holy Days and Holidays. Obviously etymologically related, we know that, but I mean literally related as well. I mean, by literally, I mean in application. They're also really closely related. So what do I mean by it? Okay, well, let's start with Christmas. In this case, Christmas. And I do mean Christmas. I'm not referring to just, you know, Christ retracted from it or something like that. I mean the whole Christmas celebration, the whole season of celebrating Christ's birth. So we celebrate Christmas and I'm going to use examples that I know are present in the way I have celebrated Christmas over the decades now, and how it has shown up in my churches and my relationships with other people and so on. And in this sense, Christmas can be an intentional, reverent recognition of the pivotal point of human history, which is the Christ event, and the moment that begins that event for us in history, for the world to know, is the conception and birth of Jesus and the whole celebration of his infancy and arriving in Bethlehem and then being raised as a little child and, you know, the celebration of the people who come to worship him and all of those things. And there are ways that in Christmas that's apparent and revealed in the way we celebrate Christmas with hymnic, you know, and I just mean hymnic by these hymns that we have. But carols that are more hymnic. We have carols that are jingle bells, you know, that kind of stuff. This, I mean, by hymnic carols, I mean the things we sing that are really about the birth of Jesus. And when I think of those, I often, I'm almost immediately drawn to what we did as candlelight services for Christmas Eve every year for years and years. And it was one of the most popular worship services that I led as a pastor in the church that I was at for so many years in Arlington. And we would sing these songs, Silent Night, Holy Night. And when you sing Silent Night, Holy Night, you know, it's a beautiful, reverent, quiet, contemplative, worshipful moment. Holy Night, the same way. Even in the dramatic presentation of it with someone whose voice might be a little too ostentatious every once in a while. And you think that about my voice all the time. You don't have to say it. I know it. Anyway, the point is, it's still very worshipful and reverent. And Hark the Herald Angels Sing, with all the joy that comes with it, is still a song that's recognizing the beauty and majesty of the presence of Christ in the world and the angels showing up to worship and recognizing the significance of what's happened. So it's not a mood thing, but the fact that it is an intentional and grave recognition of how important this moment is, joy to the world. The entire world is being transformed by this moment. O come, Emmanuel. It came upon a midnight clear, O little town of Bethlehem. Those hymnic carols are, you know, a perfect opportunity to see how Christmas, in some senses, is a really beautiful occasion annually to focus contemplatively on the meaning of the incarnation and Christ's presence in the world. That's Christmas. And then that's Holy Day, right? This is the Holy Day. We're going to have a candlelight service in a darkened room with this recognition, maybe even communion around the birth of Christ and so on. And then you have Xmas, right? So, I'll make a separate statement about this in a minute, because that's really not what this is about. But for some people, it helps make the leap in what I'm talking about here. In talking about Christ Mass, you know, we're going to come together and worship Christ. Seems pretty obviously built into the word, right? But then Xmas, you know, it's just that thing where we're having a holiday. And it's really not about that at all. I'm just going to erase this one for a minute. It's been, you know, X, the way we mark it, X, has been Christmas since Constantine, at least, with the Cairo symbol that everybody's familiar with. I mean, it's the Greek letter Chi, and it's been more than for 1,000 years, Xmas, literally Xmas, has been used to represent Christmas. So it's not a new thing, and it is about Christ. So that doesn't really make it secular or separate it from celebrating Christ. So instead, that's why I chose holidays as a replacement for holy days, because until you tell a little kid, they don't even think about the relationship between those two phrases, holy day and holiday. Holiday means holy day? I mean, it's in the word. The only thing that changes is the Y to an I, and that's just for spelling's sake, for crying out loud. And yet, most of us don't even think of it until we're adults, that the words are even related. So let's make it about that. You know, saying, and again, I don't mean this in the opposite, look at these wicked people over there, but an easy illustration of it is in the making it about happy holidays instead of Merry Christmas, right? That idea. So even that kind of Christmas, not in the I want to avoid naming Christ sense, but in the sense that you have a whole community, a whole society indeed, withdrawing from all of the mundane obligations that we have to show up for work 5 days a week or 4 days a week if you're fortunate enough to work for a place like Criswell College. The point is that we have this time of withdrawal from the mundane obligations that we normally have from day to day to be able to participate in some celebrations, some parties. You know, we're all going to get together at 11 o'clock. We're going to have a Christmas party. Everybody wear an ugly sweater, you know, and you got the Grinch on. And it's all celebrate. It's a focus on celebration. And it doesn't matter whether you're Christian or Jewish or Buddhist or Hindu or whatever, because it's not really about Christmas. It's about the holidays, right? So that kind of celebration that our whole community participates in, our whole society participates in, is different than an intentional focus on Jesus being born to Mary in a world that needed redemption, and focusing on the nature of that redemption and the gravity with which we would bow before him. There's an obvious divergence there. And I don't then this, so we're on step three now. So remember, there are four steps in this. Number one, what's it about in Christ and the focus on Jesus himself? And then what's it about in, you know, a focus that's not about Jesus, sort of the Christmas holiday and the nature of it? What's the divergence, the obvious divergence that's legitimate here? Well, look, our whole society is involved in these celebrations. Everybody's taking a break. Everybody gets the holiday. Everybody has the week off. Everybody's thinking about that week between Christmas Day and New Year's Day and the number of people that are off. I mean, 80 or 90%, depending on the survey you look at, of people in our society participate in the Christmas celebration. So because the whole society is involved in these celebrations, it's no wonder there's as much divergence over the nature of the celebration as there is in the beliefs and aims of the individuals in our society. people have different goals. They have different values. We are a pluralistic society, and it makes us a better society. Not that I don't want anyone not to believe in Jesus, but everyone's ideas sharpen us and even sharpen our Christianity and help us think through our ideas better. So we recognize we have a pluralistic society. We shouldn't be surprised that our celebrations are divergent sometimes, that somebody's wanting to get on their knees and pray and thank Jesus for coming into the world, and somebody else is wanting to get drunk at a Christmas party, which I don't celebrate, and I don't think it's a good idea to do. But I'm saying I recognize that other people are using it just for an occasion to have a party down at the bar somewhere. I get that. So even if you take it out of that extreme example, if you have Christianity on one side, including Judaism and even other religions that are celebrating something at that time of year, you know, whether it's Hanukkah that's being celebrated or some other ceremonial celebration, whatever it is that goes with their religion. But then you also have the completely non-religious and anti-religious people, the nons, you know, not even thinking about it, don't really want to be participating in anything that's church-related or institutional-related. But then the antis, you know, the ones who are really sick of religion being pushed down their throat, as they would say it, they have a different way of celebrating. So there's no surprise that there's a divergence of opinions about how the celebration ought to happen and what it ought to mean. So let me make an effort here at doing something better than us saying, well, if you don't put Merry Christmas on your store instead of Happy Holidays, I'm not shopping there. That better than that, we respond in a way that sees the potential for some reconciliation, for us to understand where other people might be coming from in the way they celebrate. So, and I'll say it for two different settings, because our setting is weird. I mean Christians. I'm referring to Christians when I say our right now. Our setting as Christians is a little weird because we're in power. And Christianity wasn't given to us in the New Testament in a position where the Christians had power. They were excluded from power. The whole point was that they had the power of the Holy Spirit, but they did not have the support or even the endorsement or tolerance of the state or the society around them. So they found themselves in jail all the time. That's why Paul ends up where he does at the end of the book of Acts. So I want to speak to Christians in power, us, the way we are, but then also to think about it in terms of Christians who are not in power, which in some ways is becoming who we are again. Despite the fact that Christianity has a name on a lot of the power that's being poised in our society right now, a lot of the things that make us Christian are deliberately excluded from the power centers that are in society right now. So I'll speak to Christians in power and Christians not in power, whichever way you conceive of yourself in this moment, to kind of understand what we're talking about. So talking to Christians in power, let me say this, that we should think of it this way, in a conciliatory tone, for people who are celebrating Christmas, but they're just, you know, putting out a bunch of lights and watching Chevy Chase in, what's it, Christmas Vacation movies. And, you know, that's the whole celebration. And I don't even know that movie. For all I know, it ends with a celebration of Jesus. I don't know. I doubt it, but I don't know for sure. So I'm not really trying to attack the movie. The point is, I mean, I'm trying to be conciliatory, so work with me here. To Christians in power, I would say this. That we do this, that we recognize the, and this is not hard. Just the fact that we're putting up Christmas trees and have nativity scenes out and all that kind of stuff, that we recognize the goodness that others who are outside the faith, for instance, who are even ignoring it, don't even care about it, that we recognize the goodness others can receive, or maybe they do receive, because we celebrate and contemplate real Christmas, you know, the point of celebrating Christ's birth, even if they don't. At least not the same way. That is that we don't focus on the fact that somebody's putting up symbols that don't represent Christ or maybe are anti-Christ, that instead of focusing on that, we focus on the fact that at this time of year, they might be doing that because they're almost suffocated by the gracious evidence that they're receiving from Christians who are all celebrating the birth of their Savior right now. When Christians are in power, wouldn't it make sense that we're happier that more people are seeing the message that comes with Christ than we are upset that there's somebody who didn't decorate their house correctly or put the right slogan on the front of their business? It's, you know, the general grace of John 1, that he lights every man. He gives light to every man that comes into the world. Does that mean they're saved? No. Does it mean everybody gets saved? No. But it does mean God is displaying his grace to every single person who comes into the world. And in that passage in John 1, he's doing it through the incarnation. There are very few images of that that could be clearer than the Christmas season sort of smothering people in the fact that we celebrate that the Son of God came into the world. And by the way, along with that is the witness, the testimony that our observance could be for them if we observed Christmas in a way that really honored the values that Christ brought into the world. I mean, think about the witness our observance could be for them if what they saw in our celebration of Christmas was love or joy or peace or patience, long-suffering, you know, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance, self-control, the things that are the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5. If that's what people saw because we were celebrating Christ and in our attitude and demeanor in response to them and the way we celebrate with each other and whether we care about whether a bunch of cars are parked in front of our house or not and all those kinds of things, if they saw in us the fruit of the Spirit, imagine how different that would be than the militancy of boycotting anyone who says happy holidays. So to Christians in power, I would say, man, let's be grateful for this opportunity for general grace to go out. And it's not even all that general. It's fairly specific. We're celebrating Jesus by name through the season. But then to Christians who are not in power. And maybe that's where we're ending up. Maybe we're ending up in a position where the genuine form of Christianity is being smothered by other forces in society. Okay, let's say that's the case. To Christians not in power, realize how blessed we are still to live in a culture that, number one, pauses long enough that we get to celebrate the birth of Jesus. I mean, whether they put up a nativity or not, whether they're singing the contemplative songs or not, man, I've got time off to go home and sit down and pray and read and focus on the birth of Jesus as a part of this celebratory time. So I can be grateful for that. And we're part of a society or a culture that doesn't prevent us from celebrating Christ and Christianity in the things we're doing. So it not only does it, so I'm saying both of these, it doesn't prevent us from doing that, but it also, our society gives us a break and an invitation to spend a day or a week or a period of time, even at the office, really focusing on the things we care about in Jesus. So you see what I'm talking about. So holy days, holidays, yeah, they have diverged. Legitimately, they have diverged and become different. But they're not incompatible. I can be grateful for the holidays and observe these holy days, either because of the holiness that I'm able to demonstrate in the world and let spread out, or the permission that I have to celebrate the holiness that Christ has allowed me to experience by him coming into the world. Either way, I got no reason to be upset with somebody else. I have a reason to be grateful for the place we are right now. Okay, so there's one Christmas opposite that I was talking about. Let me give you another example. It's not unrelated. It is related. But this one has to do with Jesus himself. And I think, you know, I think one of the things that we see as being most opposite related to Christmas. So, you know, and I'll use a passage about this one. So describing Jesus himself, you have this characteristic that's true of him, and I think most clearly stated in Luke 9. You might pick a different passage for it. You might pick Bethlehem, but I'm going to do that one as a separate discussion in next. But in this discussion, I would use Luke 9, famous passage. Jesus is going along the road, and someone says to him, "I'll follow you wherever you go." And Jesus makes this statement, "Foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." there's built in a lot to that statement. And it can be a reference to a lot of different aspects of Jesus' life. Partially that he is a traveler, that he's going to be a traveler no matter what, that he's going to go from one village to the next carrying the message about the kingdom of God. But there is a part of it, and there's no way to avoid this, but even because of what happens with the rich young ruler later. There's no way to avoid the fact that he's also saying, I don't have any possessions. I got nothing. Not only do I not have a bed, I don't have a pillow to put on a bed if I did. And I don't have a room to put a bed in if I had a bed. I don't have anything. I've got nothing. Foxes have holes. I don't even have a hole. Birds of the air have nests. I don't even have a nest. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. That's why the rest of those statements, I think, follow this pattern, not just of, you know, I'm a stranger in a strange land and I'm going to wander this whole time, but because of that, because I'm a stranger in a strange land and I don't have anywhere to wander, I also don't get caught up with all the possessions of this life. I don't need to carry around a trunk with all my trinkets in it, right? That's not what Jesus, can you imagine him having some giant duffel bag and pulling out of it some game that he wanted to play, or, you know, a video console so he could watch a movie at the end of the day? I'm not even cursing watching a movie or playing a video game. Fine. I'm just saying Jesus didn't have any of that stuff. And when he participated in stuff, he went and borrowed it from someone else. Hey, have you got a donkey I can use? I'd really appreciate it, by the way. I don't have one myself. That's the life Jesus led. I mean, he's going and asking people for everything. That's Jesus himself. The opposite side of that is, you know, Christmas. Here's Christmas. We're celebrating Jesus. And I'm talking about people who celebrate Jesus. I'm not even talking about holy day, holiday distinctions. I'm talking about Christians celebrating Jesus at Christmas. Christians celebrating the man who possessed nothing, who did not have a pillow for the bed he didn't own. That man, we celebrate him with the most commercialized period of time imaginable in the history of the world. And I'm not exaggerating. I live in America, and it's Christmas time. There is no possible example of greater wealth indulgence than what we experience every year around the Christmas season. That commercialized Christmas, you know, is, well, here, I'm going to quote from Statista, which is, you know, it's an online site. I think it's German-based. It's just information. It's just statistics. If you want to find statistics that aren't biased, that aren't trying to say something, aren't trying to make a point, that are just saying, hey, what's the answer to the question? How many of these are there? How many of those? What percentage of people do this or that? That's the place you can generally go and get information like that. And so from Statista, this is about Christmas. Because, I wanted to find out how much money is involved in the Christmas celebration, in the celebration of this man who didn't have any money, right? How much is involved? So here's the quotation. Christmas is arguably the peak point. By the way, Daisy, I think you can find the reference for it there. And she can post it for you. So Christmas is arguably the peak point, I'm quoting, of what is known as the golden quarter in retail. That's what you would expect from celebrating Jesus, right? The golden quarter of retail. It is also a civil holiday that's enjoyed by an increasing number of non-Christians and is an integral part of the holiday season. In 2024, 8 out of every 10 people in the United States, oh, this is where that statistic came from earlier, 8 out of every 10 people in the United States stated that they were planning to celebrate the holiday, with less than 1 in 10 declaring that they would not be joining in on the festivities. Christmas is typically the largest economic stimulus for many nations around the world, as sales increase dramatically in almost all retail areas during this time, according to Statista estimates. In 2024, total holiday retail sales were projected to have reached new highs of $973 billion U.S. dollars, almost $1 trillion. Come on, people, let's push it over. Let's get to $1 trillion, right? Unbelievable amounts of money being spent on Christmas. And I know it's true. I spent 2/3 of that myself on Christmas this year. So we're spending ridiculous amounts of money on Christmas as people. This is what we do. The divergence. So we're on step 3, right? So we start with Jesus and then we talk about the commercialized Christmas. And then where the divergence is obvious and legitimate. This is step three in the template that we're following. So the obvious divergence is that Jesus doesn't have a home. So, I can avoid that and just say, well, that's not about us. That's not about how we should be. That doesn't matter about Jesus now. That was just him. He gave up wealth so we could have it. I could try to follow a line like that. I get it. That's a rational explanation or argument about it, but it's not exactly gospel truth. I mean, the things Jesus says to his disciples have expectations that we follow his example, even when it regards how we view material possessions. My producer, I mentioned her a moment ago, you know, when I was talking, she'll put up a link. She did a whole series on Wednesday nights at our church, Lake Highlands Baptist Church, where she talked about how Christians ought to think about their relationship with money. And it wasn't even prescriptive in the sense of saying everybody has to give away everything they have, or everybody has to give this percentage or that percentage. It wasn't that at all. It was just learning to put your priorities where your priorities should be as a believer, as a follower of Jesus. It's, what did you say? There was a name you used. Yeah, walk where you are going. That was the expression that Daisy gave to it. Walk where you're going. We're going to the kingdom of God. We're going to the eternal. We're following Jesus. We should walk like that, as if we belong to a world that is immaterial and eternal, not to a world that is, you know, chock full in a closet somewhere that's eventually going to be thrown into a landfill. We should be thinking about it in different ways. That was the point of her lesson. So the divergence between that and what we actually do, which is celebrate Jesus, the impoverished one, we celebrate him by force-feeding our already bloated houses with even more closet fodder and shelf tchotchkes. It's a weird divergence, right? I mean, that's obvious, right? I'm not saying that's the end of it. I don't stop there. I'm just saying that's the part where we would go, how can this be? How could Jesus in a manger with hay and animals competing for space in the manger, right? How could Jesus end up being celebrated with these ostentatious displays of just the most, opulent expressions of glitter and light and jewelry and everything? It's just so the divergence is obvious, right? I'll stop. So, but there is a reconciliation to be made. And even the quote that I had from Statista sort of makes this first point in this reconciliation. Now, I'll do more about this one in the next discussion when we talk about Bethlehem. That's what will come next. But in this one, the statistics make this point. The indulgence that we're talking about isn't perpetual. It is a season. It is a pausing to, and I'm talking about the holiday. I'm not saying nobody's ostentatious. Obviously that happens, but it's not everybody being ostentatious all the time and putting a cross on it. That happens. There are people who do that. Different discussion. We can talk about, you know, prosperity doctrines and all that kind of stuff another day. The point here is that celebrating Christmas is a temporary thing. The indulgence that people participate in at this time of year is not perpetual. And these kinds of gifts, they're intended to indicate something exceptional, a disruption in our everyday lives. You know, normally you can't, I'm pretending to quote someone, right? Normally you can't get what you want, but it's Christmas. So what do you want? That demeanor that says, this is different, this is unusual, it's a disruption in the everyday dearth of your life, to provide something that indicates abundance. It's a disruption in whatever our norm would be. Now, I don't know. Now that I'm 61, and I know I repeat that all the time. It's like I'm obsessed with it. I'm not obsessed with it. I kind of am, but in a good way. I think I like having this much perspective on life. As I look back, I don't know how many people resonate with this. So when I was in my 20s and I started pastoring a congregation, I had members who would describe their Christmases when they were growing up. And, you know, we always made lots of visits at Christmas, go by and give people cards, visit the older members of the church and spend some time with them, sing some carols with them. You know, we did all that kind of stuff, right? So I would take a deacon with me, for instance, and go and visit. And I can remember a couple of different homes where I had these descriptions in, and this specific description of what Christmas was like for them. Well, when we grew up, you know, and that's how the story always starts. Well, when we grew up, and this is after they've climbed uphill both ways in the snow, bloody hands to get to school, blah, blah, blah. And honestly, the end of those conversations, in some cases for me, was me wanting to say, you went to school? It seems hard to tell. But I never did say it, so, and I didn't mean it either. That's a joke. Anyway, the point is that they would say, man, we're telling the truth. You could tell this happened to them. It's like, you know, we grew up and Christmas for us was one event. It was Christmas morning when we woke up and we had a stocking, and in the stocking there was an orange. We had an orange and we never got to have oranges. And man, we would eat that thing. And I've got to tell you, I don't eat citrus fruit all the time. It's not like I go home and break open an orange instead of, you know, something that's unhealthy. I'm not trying to obsess about anything. But you know, after hearing these stories, I got an orange for Christmas and I was delighted. It was fantastic. They would say this. They were describing their Christmas when they were young. And I'm talking about people who grew up and were alive through the Great Depression. In the 20s, they were just wondering if they were going to make it or not. And I heard those descriptions. And then I'll be honest, I had times when I would open an orange, you know, peel an orange and take the first bite and think to myself, this is glorious. I mean, this is glorious. It is so good. Why isn't this enough? Why don't we celebrate this enough? I'm saying that's what I thought to myself in following up on it. Did I stop giving gifts to my children or wanting to get gifts from my parents? No, of course not. I mean, why would I do that? But that's not the point. My point is the people who were just getting an orange, they weren't celebrating their poverty by having an orange. They were celebrating a disruption in their poverty. You know, normally we can't afford oranges. We really can't afford it today either. But we're going to get you an orange. Because the world got something good. And we want you to be able to celebrate that on this day. And arguably, even the Last Supper, and when I'm, you know, the Last Supper, the model of the Last Supper, does exactly the same thing. The Last Supper is, you know, it's a Seder. It's a Passover meal. It's the observance that a Jewish family would have, and sometimes the Jewish family with some other people would have in their home to celebrate the fact that God delivered them from Egypt, and to, you know, to take the unleavened bread and all of the elements of the Seder that you have discussed. That's what the Last Supper is with Jesus and his disciples. And think about where Jesus, it's a celebratory event. It is, in fact, it's both of the things we were talking about a few minutes ago. It's solemn, it's ceremonial, it involves prayer and repetition and a history and the value of being attached to the history of Judaism and now the history of Christianity and the crucifixion when we take the communion together as our carrying forward of the tradition of the Passover, the Seder. That Seder ceremony that Jesus is taking with his disciples is solemn and ceremonial in one sense. It's also celebratory. If you've been in any context where you have Jewish families that are present and they're celebrating Passover, I mean, it is the family getting together and it's just a beautiful celebration of family time and history as a people. And so it's both solemn and celebratory, and Jesus takes that Last Supper as he's preparing for his crucifixion. It is practically begging for us to recognize that we don't have to view even ostentatious celebrations in the Christmas season as somehow being disrespectful of the poverty of Christ. In his poverty, preparing to go to a crucifixion where the people sitting around the table with him are about to betray him. They are all about to abandon him. He will die alone. That Jesus, knowing exactly what's going to happen, he's going to say how they're going to betray him in the meal. He says he has longed to have this ceremony with them. He is enjoying the Passover meal with them. And I think there's room in that event also for us to recognize that indulgence in a season, that the celebratory nature of the commercialized Christmas season is actually something, and I'm not saying there are no violations in it. I'm not saying there's nothing rotten in it. There's plenty to criticize. There's plenty to be negative about. There's plenty for us to be concerned about. There are plenty of reasons for us as individual Christians or families to say, you know, I'm going to do this differently this year. I'm not going to spend all that money that way. I'm going to spend it this way instead, or I'm going to give it to someone else, or, you know, whatever. You do what you need to do there about your own family and your conscience. I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about how we, as believers who understand the poverty that Christ endured in this life so that he could bring salvation into the world, that we don't have to look at the ostentatious nature of the Christmas season in the outside world and think only harshly about it, but maybe pause and go, wow, that is maybe a failed effort, maybe a feigned effort, but it is an invitation to see the wealth that Christ's kingdom has, that this world doesn't, but that he was bringing to us through redemption so that we would understand what was really important. There are ways to understand it that don't make the people who think differently about the season or participate in the season differently our enemies, but reminders of the message that actually is in Christ. Okay, well, there are a couple of examples. What I want to do with this is more. I want to take it a couple of other places, so I'll give a couple of other examples in the next episode. And I know Christmas will have passed, but this applies to everything beyond Christmas too, including how we look at the new year. So I will encourage you to come back and listen next time as well for ways for us to participate in what it means to celebrate the birth of the greatest peacemaker the world has ever known.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.